the London Broadcasting Company, LBC, the independent voice of radio news.
It's 1 o'clock and this is Carol Barnes with an extended 20-minute news bulletin. On the royal wedding day, there's been a big explosion in a factory making sporting ammunition in Birmingham. Firemen are still searching for missing people and at least 20 people have been injured. More on that story later. There's a growing feeling among Tory backbenchers about the government's credit squeeze measures announced yesterday. Our political correspondent Ed Boyle reports from Westminster. I'm sorry, we seem to have lost Ed Boyle. We'll try and come back to him later. And now Gerald Luke, our economics correspondent, explains how the present credit squeeze was inevitable under the circumstances.
Think of an engine driver putting the brake on an express train that's going so fast it's in danger of jumping the rails. Well, in this case, the express train is the economy, that is industry big and small. The engine driver is the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Mr. Barber, and the brake is, of course, the credit squeeze. What has happened is that in an effort to mop up unemployment in the past 2 years, the government put a lot of extra money back into the economy by cutting taxes. The idea was that people would spend a lot of the new cash in hand. This would in turn create a demand for more goods and services, and industry would then need more men to cope with rising orders. The dream did turn into reality. Unemployment dropped dramatically as demand rose and the factories brought in new men and machinery to keep up. But then came the nightmare. Consumer demand became so great, we arrived at a situation which economists describe as overheating. Some businesses began diverting their resources from exports to the home market because of the easy pickings in the UK, and in addition, our import bill went up as our demand for foreign goods and services rose higher and higher. The result was that this year and part of last, we were not earning enough abroad to pay for the ever more costly food, raw materials, and goods we were importing. So, month after month, we've been building up an international overdraft. Not enough foreign money to pay our debts abroad. Foreigners will hold our currency for a while, but if they suspect the country is basically unsound, they sell pounds off cheap, which makes our currency abroad even more suspect. It was to prevent this that the government moved yesterday. Now, with less demand in future at home because money is more scarce, exporters will be more likely to concentrate on foreign markets, and the import bill, too, should be less high. British business leaders are in fact relieved that the government has put the brake on spending at home. While they do not like to see interest rates rising too high because of their need for money to invest in plant and machinery, they do feel that home demand was hampering export sales. The pound, the best indicator of what foreigners think of our prospects, held up well in the international money markets today, following the government decision to tighten the belt at home. One fly in the ointment is, of course, Arab oil. They are virtually in the position of charging what they like at the moment, and this is likely to be a continually rising cost item on our import bill, but one which at the moment we are unable to do without.
That was Gerald Luke. Today's happiest story has of course been the marriage of Princess Anne to Captain Mark Phillips, covered on LBC since early this morning. We take up our commentary with Paul Callan at the Victoria Memorial as he describes Princess Anne's emergence for the first time into the public view outside Buckingham Palace.
See Princess Anne there, and it is certainly, from what I can see, a most magnificently high-collared wedding dress that she's wearing, with a simple veil over her head, and I can see the veil tucked up on the other side of the coach, and she's waving and she's smiling. She looks, if anything, she looks faintly nervous. It's a beautiful white silk as far as I can see, and I could just see sitting Prince Philip beside her there, and she's waving frantically now, and the whole thing looks magnificent. The crowd has gone really quite magnificently frenzied down here at the sight of Princess Anne, as she's absolutely looking not quite so nervous, and I can see her just now going up towards the mall, followed by her ladies-in-waiting and another guest, and tailing the end off here is the rest of the sovereigns of the household cavalry.
At about the same time, the Queen and her immediate family were taking their places in Westminster Abbey. Geoffrey Talbot takes up the commentary.
Greeted by the fanfare of trumpets, greeted now by the organ, the royal procession makes its way through the choir screen into the choir itself towards the sanctuary, headed by the gentlemen ushers, and then walking at its head, Mr. Ogilvy and Princess Alexandra in green, and their children, small Marina and small James Ogilvy, then Prince Michael of Kent, the Duchess of Kent, and the Duke of Kent, Lady Helen Windsor, age 9, Earl of St. Andrews, age 11, their children, Princess Richard of Gloucester, Prince Richard of Gloucester, the Duchess of Gloucester there wearing aquamarine, Lord Snowdon, Viscount Linley, 12 years old, another of the children, Princess Margaret, Master of the Horse is there, Lord Steward, Lord Chamberlain, then the Queen walking with the Queen Mother. The Queen Mother wearing autumnal colours, beige and gold, with a sable hat, and Her Majesty the Queen in a sapphire blue silk coat and a hat with a very becoming snood to it. They're walking through the choir now to their places, walking between the drawn to attention ranks of the gentlemen at arms and the yeomen of the guard, the royal bodyguards, and now that whole royal procession, very slowly walking in stately fashion, begin to take their places in their seats in the sanctuary before the great high altar.
And that was, of course, Godfrey Talbot and not Geoffrey Talbot. A few minutes later, and the crowd inside the abbey are waiting for the arrival of Princess Anne.
And indeed, here she comes. The bridal coach has arrived at the west door of the abbey, and for the first time, we are seeing in all its full glory Princess Anne's dress. Now this, at last, we can say it and see it. Oh my goodness, it really is quite something. There she is with Prince Philip, who is, of course, in Field Marshal's uniform, a white silk full-length flowing gown with deep Elizabethan sleeves, with a train, yes, and a long veil of white silk net, which falls to the very end of the train and is held back from Princess Anne's face. She does look happy, I must say. The nervousness seems to have gone. The veil is held back from her face there by a diamond tiara, which is, incidentally, it's one lent by her grandmother, the Queen Mother, and it's the one worn by the Queen at her wedding 26 years.
The bride passes up the aisle and waits by the altar.
Now, Captain Phillips has joined Princess Anne, and they stand together at the scarlet kneeling stools in front of the sacrarium. Prince Philip, as always, the father of the bride, to the left of the princess. Captain Phillips on her right. And on his right, one step behind him, the groomsman, Captain Grounds. Facing them, the Archbishop of Canterbury, and near them, the Dean. And now the Dean.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here in the sight of God and in the face of this congregation to join together this man and this woman in holy matrimony.
The service continues as the groom takes his vows.
Long Anthony Peacock, wilt thou have this woman, thy wedded wife, to live together after God's ordinance in the holy estate of matrimony? Wilt thou love her, comfort her, honor and keep her in sickness and in health, and forsaking all other, keep thee only unto her as long as ye both shall live?
I will.
Anne Elizabeth Alice Louise, wilt thou have this man to thy wedded husband to live together after God's ordinance in the holy estate of matrimony? Wilt thou obey him and serve him, love, honor, and keep him in sickness and in health, and forsaking all other, keep thee only unto him so long as ye both shall live?
And now the central point of the service.
With this ring I be wed.
With this ring I be wed.
With my body I be worshipped.
With my body I be worshipped.
And with all my worldly goods I thee endow.
And with all my worldly goods I thee endow.
In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Ghost. Amen.
In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and the Holy Ghost. Amen.
The service ends.
Now they are man and wife. An attendant has come forward and taken away the two kneeling stools from the top of the steps of the sanctuary. And now those two figures, the one in the brilliant military scarlet and the other in white with that lovely train stretching out like a beautiful silver white tongue behind her, go forward to two more kneeling stools just below the altar steps themselves.
After the signing of the register, the royal couple emerged to a fanfare of trumpets.
Princess Anne, on the arm of her husband, walks slowly from the sanctuary, pausing to salute, to do a bow to the sovereign, to the Queen, on their way.
There'll be a programme of edited highlights of the day later on this evening on LBC. And now that report from Ed Boyle on Tory backbench concern over the government's credit squeeze measures.
There is nothing, surely some government ministers must be saying to themselves today, quite like a royal wedding. For as they worry and furrow their brows at yesterday's gloomy trade figures, at least the cameras are focused on Westminster Abbey across the road. Indeed, in the realm of timely coincidence, the wedding is like manna from heaven. The party leaders are side by side in the pews, and even the Conservative Party's critics in the main have taken time off to watch the ceremony rather than snipe at their leaders. Nevertheless, yesterday's trade figures and the introduction of measures to curb bank lending makes Mr. Heath's pledge for growth, growth and growth again look uncommonly limp. It does go partway to placating some right-wing Tory backbenchers who regarded the economic expansion policy as ill-conceived, but their reaction today mainly is to say, well, yes, but what about cutting the budget deficit too by means of taxation? Or simply muttering, we told you so. Well, that is clearly Mr. Enoch Powell's reaction, but he's not muttering it. Mr. Powell rarely mutters. Indeed, we hope to be bringing you an interview with Mr. Powell later on in this bulletin. There's concern even in the Conservative Backbench 1922 Committee, not a body of men noted for fierce criticism of their political masters. They've asked the Chancellor, Mr. Barber, to come and explain himself to their next meeting. And though they might not say it out loud, there is a suspicion, similar to the suspicion in the opposition Chancellor Mr. Healy's mind, that yesterday's trade figures were predictable a week or more ago. Two resignations of parliamentary private secretaries yesterday would seem to indicate at least mild frustration and dissatisfaction with the government's policy, though one of the men who's left his secretarial post, Mr. Norman Tebbit MP, told me this morning he simply wanted to be able to expose the unacceptable fates of politically motivated trade unionists. As for Mr. Wilson and the opposition, they will be hitting hard at the government tomorrow in the debate on emergency powers regulations. And in total, the next few weeks look less stable for the Prime Minister than at any time since he took office. This is Ed Boyle from Westminster.
The central bank governors of the main monetary powers abolished the two-tier gold system yesterday. For the implications of this move, here's Paul Weitzel of the Financial Times.
When the last monetary crisis but one occurred in 1968,
The world's major monetary powers, America and the European nations, agreed to set up a two-tier market for gold. There would be the official gold market on which they would trade their reserves, the bars of bullion that line the Bank of England, Fort Knox and other government depositories. Then there would be the free market, where jewellers, private investors and speculators would trade the metal at prices subject to the forces of supply and demand. Unfortunately, the system didn't work. While governments were tied to an official gold price of $38 and later $42 an ounce, the free market price has risen since the Smithsonian Agreement to well over double the official price, and earlier this year reached nearly $130 an ounce. This discrepancy between the free and official prices effectively froze the gold reserves of governments, since to sell them at $42 would have been rather like selling a pound for 50 pence. Yesterday, in Basel, the main central bank governors finally accepted the failure of the two-tier system. They abolished it and assumed the right to sell their gold reserves on the free market. What happens now is difficult to predict. Free market dealers in London say that yesterday's move won't allow the central banks to unfreeze their gold reserves, since the amount of bullion they would need to sell to achieve this would depress the free market price down towards the unrealistic official level, which would defeat the purpose of the exercise. Their argument has some force, because under the International Monetary Fund's rules, central banks still cannot buy on the free market. This should not deter some countries, such as West Germany, from selling a trickle of their gold reserves. But others, like Britain and America, have no intention of taking advantage of their new powers for the time being. So, what was the point of the Basel Declaration? Well, first, it tidies up and gets rid of an anachronism on the monetary scene. Secondly, and most important, the move makes the general political point that governments are still committed to easing gold out of a reformed monetary system in the future, and are still committed to meet the deadline next summer for drawing up a blueprint for such a reformed system.
Paul Weitzel of the Financial Times. Now more on the big explosion which shook Birmingham. Here's Joe Quinn from Birmingham.
At least 20 people are thought to be injured. The explosion was at the factory of Imperial Metal Industries Limited in the North Birmingham suburb of The explosion is thought to have been in the sporting ammunition section of the factory. The fire brigade says it was a severe explosion which caused extensive damage. 8 fire engines have gone to the scene and 10 ambulances. The injured people are being ferried to various hospitals in the city. At Birmingham Accident Hospital, a spokesman said that 4 people had been brought in. More were expected. One of the 4 was being treated in the major injuries unit. The other 3 are in the casualty department.
Joe Quinn in Birmingham, and we've just heard that 3 people have died as a result of the explosion. According to TASS, the official Soviet news agency, Israeli troops have surrounded the United Nations checkpoint at kilometre 101 on the Suez-Cairo road. TASS calls the move an attempt to exercise psychological pressure and blackmail, and the UN Emergency Force Commander has strongly protested. The Israelis seem to be dug in at the checkpoint, and they're stopping every vehicle which passes through, going over them with a fine-tooth comb. Here's Granville Watts from Cairo.
The Israelis stop every convoy and check the trucks before letting them through. We watched a convoy of about 10 Egyptian trucks driven by UN drivers and loaded with food for the Egyptian Third Army, which has been encircled on the east bank of the Suez Canal. The convoy was held up for 5 hours before it was allowed through. An Egyptian officer told me that a Red Cross truck with blood aboard for the wounded of Suez town was held up for 4 hours the previous day. He said even the blood bottles had been inspected by the Israelis before they allowed the trucks through. It was evident to the newsmen who visited the checkpoint that the Israelis were showing no signs of departing soon. Some Israelis were filling fresh sandbags for positions beside the road, and on a nearby ridge, 2 bulldozers were at work building new gun emplacements which will command the road even if the Israelis remove their checkpoints.
Granville Watts in Cairo. General Yarib, Mrs. Meir's special assistant, will have some hard propositions when he talks to his Egyptian opposite number at kilometer 101 today. Hugh Orgel reports from Tel Aviv.
Israel's representative at today's meeting between Israeli and Egyptian officers, Major General Aharon Yariv, will stress to his Egyptian opposite number that two checkpoints on the Cairo-Suez Road will not be handed over to the United Nations Emergency Force until the Egyptians hand over the names of the Israeli prisoners of war they hold. The new instructions were worked out by Prime Minister Golda Meir, Defense Minister Moshe Dayan, and their top aides. Once this is done, Israel says the Egyptians are bound by the agreement to begin the prisoner of war exchange itself.
Hugh Orgel in Tel Aviv. In Geneva, the International Committee of the Red Cross says it hopes to start moving wounded prisoners after today's meeting between the Israelis and Egyptians. Two Red Cross planes are standing by in Cyprus, ready to transport wounded prisoners as soon as the two sides give the go-ahead. Others will be going home by sea or road. But in Egypt, there's a great deal of concern at the Israelis' hardline attitude. Granville Watt sends us this report from Cairo.
Egypt today warned of grave consequences which may follow Israel's continued refusal to carry out provisions of the six-point ceasefire agreement. Egyptian newspapers commented on a statement by Premier Golda Meir that Israeli troops will not return to the October 22nd truce lines because she says no such lines exist. The Cairo newspaper, Al Gamouria, asked, what will the United States do now to honor its commitments to the agreement?
Granville Watson, Cairo. Meanwhile, a series of meetings are being planned among Arab leaders. Mr. Mahmoud Riyad, the Secretary General of the Arab League, has invited Arab kings and presidents to attend an Arab summit in Algiers on November the 26th. Reporting from Cairo, the Iraqi news agency says that Algiers was chosen at the request of the presidents of Egypt and Syria. It says the summit will discuss the current Middle East situation and continued Arab mobilization. There'll be a separate meeting for foreign ministers in Algiers on the 24th, according to the official Syrian news agency. And the Beirut newspaper Al Anwar says today that the question of Arab participation in the proposed Middle East conference will be discussed. The conference is due to take place in Geneva on December the 10th. It also says the Palestinian question will be debated. The Palestinian guerrilla leader, Yasser Arafat, was in Beirut today talking to the Lebanese premier, according to Palestinian sources. Arafat arrived from Damascus after visits to several Arab countries, and the sources say he will chair a meeting of the Palestine Liberation Organization in Beirut. He'll inform it of the outcome of his talks. Beirut press reports say he'll be leading a guerrilla declaration on a visit to Moscow next week. And there'll be an extraordinary session of the Organization of African Unity Council of Ministers in Addis Ababa next Monday. It'll discuss the current Middle East situation. In Rome, Pope Paul has called for a speedy Arab-Israeli prisoner exchange as a first step towards a peace settlement. He asked the whole world to pray for this as a sign of a new will for peace. Two Dutch envoys have arrived in Saudi Arabia, and there's speculation that they will have talks about the Arab oil embargo against Holland. Dutch officials have hinted that the visit is closely linked with the embargo. It's the first mission by Dutch envoys to the country since Saudi Arabia imposed its oil embargo. And in Brussels, the American Assistant Secretary of State, Joseph Sisko, has met NATO ambassadors and told them about the American peace plan for the Middle East. Common market countries have been urged to take economic countermeasures against those countries that reduce oil supplies to the European community. This action comes in a resolution which was passed by the European Parliament in Strasbourg early today, following a debate on the oil crisis. Although the European Parliament was unable to decide what specific countermeasures the European community should take, a number of suggestions were made. They are that existing trade agreements with some Arab countries should be freezed, and that common market countries should refuse to grant work permits to immigrant workers from North Africa and the Middle East. The U.S. Secretary of State, Dr. Henry Kissinger, is now in Tokyo after his talks with Chinese leaders in Peking. The talks seem to have been a success on both sides. After a 2¾-hour meeting with Dr. Kissinger, Chairman Mao spoke a few words in English. He asked Dr. Kissinger to send President Nixon his regards. Observers can't remember the last time Chairman Mao spoke English, and this is regarded as a significant gesture of friendship towards the United States. Dr. Kissinger was given a warm send-off when he left for Tokyo. Chinese leaders chatted and joked with him for a few minutes in public before he left. Dr. Kissinger himself is said to be very pleased with the outcome of the affairs. Jonathan Sharp reports from Peking.
Dr. Henry Kissinger has left Peking at the end of his sixth visit to China. He said before flying to Tokyo that he was leaving with a feeling of satisfaction over the progress made in his talks with Chinese leaders. He said that the United States' relationship with China was now a constant factor in American foreign policy, no matter what happened in the United States in future. This was an apparent reference to the uncertainty over future political development in the United States.
The Prime Minister of Australia said today that heads of government of the Western Pacific countries ought to confer regularly. He said that sooner or later China would have to be brought in too, but he thought it would be better if Russia and the US kept out. More on the economic squeeze. Ed Boyle asked Mr. Enoch Powell how pleased he was with what the government did yesterday.
They're still evading the heart of the matter. What the events that came to a head yesterday, if they have yet come to a head, showed is that we can't go on living with 10% inflation going on upwards without very serious consequences, internal and external. Both we ourselves and the rest of the world looking on say, look, the British have got an inflation and it isn't getting any better, it's getting worse. And they've got a policy called the Prices and Incomes Policy, which is clearly designed to accommodate 10% inflation and more. So, chaps, that's not where to put our money. Now, the only remedy is to stop inflating. And it is the government that does the inflating. It is the relationship between government expenditure and the way in which it is financed, which causes inflation. Nobody seriously disputes this, except when they're on a political platform. Consequently, to put up interest rates will only make it harder for the government to borrow money from the public, who've been bitten that way a good many times before, then discovered that interest rates went up still higher. And to restrict the credit base of the banks by calling for special deposits doesn't really do any good if the next day the government pop around to the back door of the banks and say, lend us a dime, which of course is what they do all the time. So you've got to get down to the heart of the matter, and there's no secret about what to do. On the eve of a budget last year, I said that I could see no escape for the Chancellor from the disagreeable necessity not merely of planning a reduction in the rate of increase of public expenditure, but increasing taxation in the short run. And then when he didn't, I said so again in August. And then when he didn't, he was very angry with me in October.
Mr. Enoch Powell. Football. The inclusion of Chelsea's Peter Osgood and West Ham's Bobby Moore in England's team to play Italy tonight should ensure an attendance of close to 90,000 at Wembley. Moore, who was dropped from the last two England games, equals Billy Wright's record by captaining his country for the 90th time. And London fans will be keen to pay their tributes in what could be his last international appearance. Speculation that Sir Alf Ramsey might resign as England manager after tonight's game, whatever the result, has now died down. But he and his players have something to prove after dismissal from the World Cup by Poland last month. And that's the news. We'll have another news bulletin for you at 2 o'clock.
Welcome back to the Wedding Day special, and we go on for another 32 minutes bringing you the final news of the wedding celebration, because of course they're not all over yet. The royal couple, the happy couple, are going to be appearing on the balcony outside Buckingham Palace shortly, and also Janet Street Porter, who's here with her guests, will be picking over the fashion scene in the minutes ahead. Two other items of royal news. 2,000 telegrams have been received at the palace, at Buckingham Palace so far, and 11 bags of mail for Princess Anne. This is 70 times the normal amount of Buckingham Palace mail. And news from Great Somerford, from the home of Mark Phillips. The wedding celebration peal by bell ringers at Great Somerford was interrupted when one of the bell mechanisms broke, unfortunately. It was the first time in 8 years that a peal had been rung on the four bells, and there were fears that the bells would fall down. One ringer wearing industrial earmuffs was in the belfry as the others began pulling on the ropes. According to the church warden, the 15th century wooden wheel on which one bell is rung twisted. The rope was torn up into the belfry, and if the ringer hadn't let it go, he would have been taken up with it. But the villagers continued ringing their special wedding peal on three bells. And now let's go back over to the royal route. And first of all, to Gillian Strickland, who I hope is standing by there. First of all, Gillian, have you had a nice day? Gillian Strickland, are you there? No, Gillian Strickland. I wonder if
she's got off from her sandwiches.
Her sandwiches? You don't have sandwiches when you're taking part in a royal wedding day special. No chance of getting Gillian Strickland for the moment? No chance at all.
With the sandwiches. Can you hear me, David?
We can hear you now, yeah.
Right.
Was it sandwiches?
The sandwiches have gone to my head. Yes, it was sandwiches. You're absolutely right. In fact, I'm still here with my sandwiches, but it's quite remarkable how the crowd has disappeared. So at one point, when the last of the coaches went past, people just sort of stood and stared in the way that they do, you know, faintly expecting something else, although nothing else is going to happen. And then the police had two sort of rival processions on their hands. One was all the people making their way down the Mall towards Buckingham Palace, where I should think Paul Callan has been completely mobbed by this time. And the other, people going completely the opposite direction, towards Trafalgar Square Underground Station. But now everybody's disappeared. Already they're cleaning the streets, they're sweeping up the litter, there's a van washing the curbs, and it's just very strange how quickly all traces have passed over. There are one or two rather grand people who have come away from the Abbey itself, and two bishops in gaiters and frock coats. I think we're going for a late lunch at the Athenaeum. But the more humble are now walking down the Mall towards the balcony, where in a few minutes' time they should be coming out. Are you ready to go over to the balcony now, David?
Well, first of all, I'd just like to ask you, Gillian, if there's one scene you will remember from this morning, which scene would that be?
Oh, I liked the bit when the household cavalry trooper's horse got out of control. I think accidents are always the best bits. He was very splendid, I must say. Puce in the face with rage and embarrassment. He got, as I say, he got a great cheer from the crowd. In fact, he probably got the biggest cheer of all from this part of the crowd. They were strangely subdued. They waved their flags and they looked, but there was very little noise. The Queen, in fact, got the biggest reaction from the crowd here, apart from the trooper, that is. She seemed very popular, and she looked tremendously happy when she came past here in the procession going back to Buckingham Palace.
Gillian Strickland, thank you very much. I believe that Paul Cullen is poised for the moment when the happy couple and the royal family come out on the balcony. So over to you, Paul.
Yes, David, I'm standing here, and I'm glad that Gillian's having some nourishment. I must say, I feel rather grander because I've been eating out of my Fortnum's hamper here. A rather daunting little bottle of claret was there. It was a 1962 Chateau Lafite, so it went down a fair old treat on this rather cold day. So far, there's no sign of the royal family coming out onto the balcony. But what has been quite impressive is that, as Gillian quite rightly said, the whole area right in front of Buckingham Palace is a carpet of people. I've never seen so many people so closely packed together, standing side by side. There can't be very much breathing space. It was really quite dramatic because they suddenly and quite unexpectedly broke the ranks, and the poor police who were doing a very valiant job here today were swept aside. One poor young constable quite unfortunately even had his helmet knocked off by the initial rush of enthusiasm by people who are now pressed hard up against the railings of Buckingham Palace. And there are one or two attempts, I think, just over on the right-hand side towards Green Park, of people shouting, "We want Anne, we want Anne." But so far there's no sign of any of them. I imagine they're still having their wedding breakfast, richly deserved. And as soon as I do see the slightest suggestion of a royal personage on that balcony, always a scene for lovers, balcony scenes, I'll be back in touch with you, David, and I'll describe the scene as it occurs then.
Thanks, Paul. And as you heard Paul Cavan say, as soon as the happy couple are out on the balcony, he'll be bringing us the news of it. Well, Janet Streetwater, you better reintroduce our guests, because I think after 3 hours, a few people might have forgotten who they are.
Yes, well, with me in the studio is James Judd, who wrote The House of Windsor, published by Macdonald, and David Sassoon, a Belleville Sassoon, who designed the clothes of Princess Alexandra, the Duchess of Kent, and Princess Richard of Gloucester. First of all, I'd like to ask Dennis, do you think that an occasion like today, in fact, pleases people because they like to see the monarchy so far removed from reality, and they really enjoy things like glass coaches and ceremony and lots of uniforms?
Do the public like having their royalty really behind glass cages, really?
Well, you see, it's very difficult. I'm sure that you can't categorise the public into any particular group of people. I think some people undoubtedly love the mystique and the glass carriages bit. I think there might be many people less fortunate in the economic climate of this particular day who might resent the glass cages and the pomp and circumstance a bit. It's very difficult, isn't it? I suppose that the public gets the monarchy it deserves.
Any thought, though, on the relevance of this on a day when the headlines say stock market slides, lights go out as emergency powers bite, Treasury clamps down, bank curbs, dearer overdrafts, sterling unsteady, ambulance ban, newspapers disrupted, halt London call.
Sure.
Bank rate through the roof, worst trade figures on record, disaster day for Britain, it's lights out on day of gloom, petrol coupons next week. Those are some of the headlines today, and it's going to be back to reality with quite a bump, isn't it?
It turns out to be ghastly, doesn't it? Yes, but maybe this is one of the points of a royal jamboree like this, that you can divert, you know, a bit of attention, a bread and circuses sort of thing, from economic gloom. It doesn't really affect the life of the nation for more than a week or so.
The funny thing was that we had Rex Reed on 2 in the morning yesterday. He's a New York film critic and probably the most acid writer in America, writing about celebrities. And he was specially here for the wedding, and he thought it was quite wonderful. And he said, of course, in America, we haven't got any aristocracy, we haven't got a monarchy, and now Richard Nixon's in such trouble. We haven't even got a president that the majority of people look up to. And he was going to write an article about it, and he saw it in a totally different way.
Well, most people have. Yes, I think it's probably very easy for Americans to see it in a very different way. I think that they have got a royal family in exile, the Kennedys, you know, in a sense, waiting on the wings to come back and claim their own back. But, comparing Richard Nixon with the monarchy, I'm a whole prefer the monarchy.
David Sassoon, you designed a lot of the clothes that were worn today, but not the royal wedding dress. What do you think of Princess Anne's dress? Do you think it lived up to expectations?
Well, as a fashion designer, I've been waiting literally with bated breath for the first glimpse of Princess Anne's wedding dress. And for me, that's the highlight almost of the whole wedding procession, waiting to actually see the dress in its full bloom coming down the aisle. And I must say that I think Maureen Baker has been very clever, inasmuch that she has designed a dress which is both royal, traditional, and at the same time has a certain amount of glamour attached to it. I liked the sleeves, which were very Elizabethan in feeling, or slightly medieval, and I think they looked very grand coming down the aisle. It was the first thing you noticed, and I liked the fact that the dress, in fact, was very simple from the front, and the train at the back, when the cameras got onto it, looked very important. When you are, in fact, designing a dress that has to be seen in an abbey, it has to be important looking. And I think, as far as that's concerned, Maureen Baker has done a very good job.
Of course, one of the things about Princess Anne's dress, it's more than just a dress that she wears for one day. It's a dress that wedding dress manufacturers all over the country are going to have knocked off in a matter of, well, I'm sure they're out there drawing boards right now, their pencils poised. And certainly from next Saturday, girls are going to be getting married in line for line copies of that dress. And when you look at it like that, do you think it's an original dress?
I think it's a dress that the wholesale are going to be able to copy very easily, because it doesn't have any very complicated pleating or embroidery that is too difficult to interpret in a cheaper form of some kind. So I do a vision that a lot of high street shops are going to carry inexpensive replicas of Princess Anne. And I think come the spring of next year, at Easter time, when we have so many brides, I do think a lot of them will be in little replicas of Princess Anne.
When do you think, Janet, in fact, that the first replica is going to be on the street by 3 o'clock or something?
3 o'clock this afternoon, yes, in Birkitex and Oxford Street. I mean, I'll wait to see it.
Garlanded with all the 5,000...
I don't think I'll be able to get 5,000 pearls on by 3 o'clock.
Or even 5,000 pears.
I think those can be left off somehow.
One thing that we remarked upon was that the carpet in Westminster Abbey was bright blue, and when you saw it, you immediately said, oh my goodness me, if only they told me that it was going to be bright blue, because it clashes with so many colours.
It does indeed, and I think Mr. Hartnell has been very clever in choosing the colour for the outfit for the Queen, because it blended very much in tone with the outfit, in fact, that she wore.
Mm. Do you think that, I noticed that one of the ladies in waiting had an outfit the same colour
as the
Queen. Very similar colour
indeed, yeah.
And, I mean, what do you think about that? That was a bit...
Yes, I must say, that was, I'm very surprised to see that, that a colour so near the one the Queen was wearing, that someone should literally be walking behind her in almost the identical colour.
But tell me something else, when you design... You designed three of the outfits. Now, three of the women you designed for were standing very close together. When you design clothes for the royal family, do you know what the other people at the occasion are going to be wearing? Did you know that Mrs. Phillips was going to wear the dress, the colour that she was wearing?
I think that the royal family know there are certain colours that they have been told not to use. And then they more or less give us carte blanche.
I must interrupt here because I believe that the happy couple are now emerging onto the balcony over to Paul Callan.
Yes, David, they are emerging, and a great sigh has gone up because there is Lieutenant Captain Phillips on the left-hand side in his scarlet uniform, and I can just get my binoculars to my eyes. Princess Anne standing there looking really quite magnificently beautiful, holding the bouquet in front of her. There's her young brother standing to her over on my left-hand side, and Lady Sarah Armstrong Jones, and I can see just in the background the Queen, very smiling and just turning back to look into the balcony, and it's very exciting. Now, Lieutenant Phillips is just... Captain Phillips, I keep demoting him. Captain Phillips, over. And now the Queen has stepped out, hence the great... wave of applause and shouting here has been joined by the Queen Mother and Prince Philip. Over on the left-hand side, dressed in vivid green, is Princess Alexandra, and then there's Mr. Angus Ogilvy. Standing just to my left, just slightly behind Captain Phillips, is Captain Grounds, Captain Phillips' best man. Prince Philip seems to be doing some sort of geographical discussion or lesson, tutorial with the Queen Mother there, pointing over towards Green Park. Now he's turning around and he's talking, I can see, to the Prince of Wales, who's just suddenly joined us, standing behind his mother, the Queen. And they're all waving and they're all looking very happy, and I'm looking at this crowd, and it's really quite a moving sight to see sea of Union Jacks flapping away. That's something we seldom see these days. They're all looking remarkably relaxed and composed, and if I can just raise my racing glasses to my eyes, perhaps I can just see a few of the expressions on their faces for a moment. Yes, that's a little better. Well, they must look very relaxed. Captain Phillips is gazing around. He's talking just for a moment, having a word with his best man. Staring up now, just he's talking. He and Princess Anne are saying something. Would that I could lip read. What must they be saying? The Queen is waving, looking very happy. She must have had a silent tear, I imagine, like any mother who sees her daughter married on a day like this. Young Prince Andrew looking very, very chirpy and alert there. And they seem to be turning around, and Prince Charles is just standing to one side. They've turned and they seem to be going off the balcony, and the Queen's gone back in. And now they're turning around, and the crowd are very reluctant to let them go.
They seem in general to be going back, but Princess Anne and her husband, Captain Phillips, are staying here just alone. What a nice gesture. The other members of the royal family have left just to leave this couple alone. And you can hear the great crowd here, just absolutely full of affection and joy from this royal wedding. And they're just alone, absolutely alone now, on the balcony here at Buckingham Palace. Princess Anne and her husband, Captain Phillips, with little Lady Sarah Armstrong-Jones jigging up and down, rather. Terribly excited she must be. What a great day must be for her. What a sweet little girl. Now, Princess Anne is turning around. She just putting a train, flicking it behind her, giving a parting wave. There was great enthusiasm, and Captain Phillips is now just following her in, accompanied by her page and her bride. They've gone inside, and I can see Captain Phillips having a brief word with Princess Alexandra. I imagine she's saying, how are you feeling for your first confrontation on the balcony? This balcony, as I say, traditionally in a Romeo and Juliet-ish way, immediately associated and linked with love scenes. I can see them all grouped there. Princess Alexandra, and I say her vivid green, actually standing out magnificently with her husband, Mr. Angus Ogilvy. And I imagine that the crowd are rather enthusiastic that they should lure them out again. This has been the scene of so many parts of our national history here, this balcony scene, when there are moments of great national grief or great national joy, somehow people seem magnetized, drawn to this spot. It was here that King George V came out no less than 12 times to the tune of "For He's a Jolly Good Fellow." And two here in 1945 were the King and the Queen, the two little princesses, as they, well, not so little, but the two princesses, Mary Rose and Princess Elizabeth, later to become the Queen, stepped out. And now the crowd has gone on again because Captain Phillips and Princess Anne have come out just alone, just the two of them. And just like, virtually like any other married couple, and they're waving from the balcony, both looking very happy. In fact, Princess Anne looks absolutely joyous, as indeed she should on this her wedding day. And now gazing over towards Green Park, a special wave to a group of people I've seen Princess Anne pointing to. I wonder who they must be. And now they're just turning around again, endeavour to go in. I suppose they want to get back into the warm because it is quite cold here now. The sun came out a little earlier on. Some gentleman in the crowd has played his own personal fanfare there on his own trumpet. They've gone right back here, right into the room just leading out onto the, which leads the back of the balcony there. So I don't know to what extent they'll be coming back. But if they do come back, well, I'll certainly come back to you, David. At the moment, there's a very joyous, happy crowd here surrounding Buckingham Palace. People clambered up onto the railings. A lot of small boys actually holding on for dear life in the expectation. I can see Princess Anne just looking over her shoulder alone, standing on that crowd, staring at the crowd here. And they seem to be going away. If they come back, David, well, I'll certainly come back to you. And I'll hand back to you now in the studio.
Paul Cullen, thanks very much, outside Buckingham Palace, as the happy couple seem to have left after positively their final appearance, off, of course, now to their honeymoon, which is, of course, shrouded in secrecy, the actual route they'll be taking. Well, Janet, looking back over these last, however many hours has it been? 5 hours. How did you think?
I spent more time alone than you, Dave, and I'm with my husband.
How did you think Princess Anne looked?
I think she looked pretty good. I thought she has obviously lost a lot of weight and her face looked much thinner. I thought she looks much better for having lost the weight. I mean, the transformation in her over the last 6 months has been fantastic. She was almost unrecognisable as the same girl this time last year. I liked her hair, I thought that looked very pretty.
I mean, obviously they did the hair like that for Norman Parkinson photographs, and it was such a smash hit, they repeated it for the day, that sort of sideswept thing. That suits her very much, and it suits that sort of chin she's got. As for her makeup, I liked it. I thought she had rather too much rouge on, but I think it's being a bit catty, but only in that I think that they're very conscious of the fact they're going to be on television. They do look as if they loaded it on a bit. She looked really good. I would have had a bit less rouge, but actually got a bit chilly. It showed a bit more. Anyway, the other thing is, I thought, I liked her dress. I wasn't crazy about the sleeves. I think double sleeves, a bit vulgar, but I like the dress generally. Dennis Judd, you sat through us with us on this great marathon, with like one big happy family here at LBC in a debris-strewn studio. What do you think Princess Anne's future role is going to be? Do you think she's going to withdraw more now to private life? Because on the television film she said she really, you know, she made it clear that A, she didn't really want to live in London, she only lived in London because it seemed to be necessary, and she would like to live in Scotland. Do you think she's going to try and withdraw from the public eye now?
Well, I think we must remember that she's now Mrs. Phillips, and Captain Phillips has a job. And although he can't be sent to a far-flung portion of the Empire anymore, Aden or Borneo, and she'd have to go with him, I presume he will have some military duties still to perform. And I guess she'll have to go with him sometimes. Or if not all the time, otherwise it's going to be a bit odd. I should have thought that it would be very difficult for her to escape from the functions of royalty, though, you know, planting cherry trees in obscure corners in the provinces and this sort of thing. I'm sure she'll do her ration of that.
And probably how do you think the other army wives are going to treat her?
I suppose with dreadful deference to begin with, I suppose, and then probably they'll get the perspective from.
What should be the correct perspectives to treat Princess Anne? Because one has heard that she is sometimes a rather touchy lady, and she likes to stand on a certain amount of ceremony.
But this is not unknown in the royal family, is it? It's something said quite commonly about other members of the royal family. I suppose it's their prerogative. They put up with quite a lot of pestering. I suppose a bit of touchiness here and there is understandable.
I think I'd be interested to see how Princess Anne sort of operates in army life and getting on with other wives. But I think one thing that I remember when I got married, the day after the terrific letdown, one way or another, I mean tomorrow, I mean, I wonder how she's going to feel getting up tomorrow morning. We've heard from the television film that she's only going to be able to do scrambled or boiled eggs. But at least he knows that in advance.
True. Well, I think she might feel actually rather tremendous tomorrow. Mm. Because I don't think we should underestimate the pressure of this sort of ceremonial.
I mean, she's had a pretty rough time the last 2 weeks.
Absolutely ghastly. And I think that monarchs and royalty approach coronations and similar ceremonials with a lot of trepidation. I think we shouldn't underestimate the nervous strain. Royal tours as well, you know, there are quite well-documented examples of, say, Edward VIII, Duke of Windsor. He nearly had a nervous breakdown on some of his royal tours as Prince of Wales. The pressure was so great and continuous.
She would have had engagements every minute of the last 2 weeks.
I should have
had
so.
Dave Sassoon, do you think she'll be dying to get out of that frock and get into a pair of jeans to go? Because she's often said that she hates being dressed up and she only dresses up because it's expected of her. Do you think she'll be sticking on a pair of jeans to go on her honeymoon?
I should think she'd be very glad to get out of her wedding dress, because I know that a dress that has a train of that length must have a lot of very stiff petticoats underneath to hold it out, and they can't be the easiest of things either to manage or to sit comfortably in. So I'm sure she can't wait to get that great weight off. And also the tiara, she obviously has great difficulty in balancing it on the centre of her head. And I think she'd be rather relieved to put her hair down and get into these comfortable jeans.
She does look much more at home in a hat or a scarf than a tiara, doesn't she? I mean, I'm sure she's been terribly well trained to wear one, but the weight must be fantastic.
I think she, in fact, the particular tiara that she has on today looks extremely glamorous on her. And I think it's a rather nice touch that, in fact, she is wearing the same tiara that her mother wore when she got married.
Do you think Princess Anne has ordered a lot of clothes for her honeymoon, or she'll be just wearing jeans and T-shirts.
Well, I have read in various newspapers that she has ordered quite a few clothes to take on her honeymoon with her. And one newspaper in particular listed the fact that she had is taking a lot of hat boxes with her. So she's going to take, I'm sure, some more of her famous hats with her.
Yeah.
Just to change the subject for the moment and to go over to Great Somerford, strangely neglected part of Britain during today's proceedings. Of course, Great Somerford, the home of Captain Mark Phillips and his family. Earlier we told you about the bells ringing down at the church there, and one of the bells actually broke, at least one of the strings for the bells, one of the ropes for the bells, one of the pulleys for the bells did break. The special wedding peal of bells was spoilt when one of those broke. But before that happened, Geoffrey Lakeman managed to send us this report.
Standing now in the garden of the Phillips home in Great Somerford, and with me are two rather sorry-looking members of the family. Their names are Joker and Dougal, and they're two of the Phillips horses. We're only about 30 yards away from St. Peter and St. Paul's, the parish church, and any moment now, we're going to hear a sound that hasn't been heard for 8 years. And there it is, the first of the bells at the parish church. Some of the youngsters here have never heard this sound before. And there it is, the first full peal from the parish church bells that have been heard in 8 years. In fact, we've had to bring ringers in from surrounding villages. And there is a danger, I'm told, of the bells falling down. There's one ringer up in the belfry wearing industrial earmuffs, and he's watching the bells closely to make sure that the ringer is in no danger. This is Geoffrey Lakeman reporting from Great Somerford in Wiltshire.
Lovely, the sound of country church bells, aren't they? 5.5 minutes to two now, and of course at 2 o'clock we more or less get back to our schedule on London Broadcasting. We have a full news bulletin at 2 o'clock, and after that George Gale will be back with his open line to you. You ring him and he'll be talking to you about any subject under the sun, though I expect the main subjects today are likely to be that wedding of Princess Anne and Mark Phillips, though I'm sure you'll also be wanting to talk to him about the economic crisis and direr things and murkier and darker.
Mortgages
and bacteriality, yes.
Oh, I know. I mean, what delighted me most about the royal wedding is it took my mind off my bank load, which I thought about on the way to work today. I felt quite sick. And I sort of wrote a mental note to ring up the bank manager and ask him starting how much more I owe him since yesterday, because it doesn't seem to go down anymore. It only seems to go up. But I was rather wondering what Princess Anne's going to wear to go away, because I remember when she went up the balcony just now on the television screen, we could see her almost look as if she tripped over her train. There was this lovely thing where she suddenly turned round like every bride does, with that expression, I put my foot in it. And when you've got a train of that length, it must be terribly difficult, Dave, not to sort of get all tangled up in it. Do you think she had lessons in...
I think so, and I hope that her little bridesmaid, who is in attendance, is going to be helpful and lift all those various layers of trains out of place so that she doesn't, in fact, trip up.
She looked at it for a moment with all that coming in and onto the balcony and darting back indoors as if she got herself really in a twist. But I remember at my wedding reception, I couldn't wait. I'm getting quite nostalgic today. I couldn't wait to get my wedding dress on. And I couldn't find anything else to wear. I think I spent my entire wedding reception in an old pair of jeans, just because the strain of being smart for me, more than 3 hours, quite wore me out. Dennis, what's your reaction to the events of today? What do you think?
If I could just... But in there, I was going to say that getting in a twist can happen, you know, on this royal occasion. George VI at his coronation, he was about to sweep off down the aisle, and one of the bishops was standing on his robe, and it brought him up absolutely to a dead halt, and he had to get him off, and that's very difficult. My reaction to today, right, well, I'm pleased it's all over, in more ways than one. I wish them happiness. I wish the people who stood out in the rather cold but sunny day enjoyed it. I hope they enjoyed it rather. And now perhaps we can get back to the reality of life. not necessarily mortgages, but trying to make mortgages available for young couples.
Do you think?
Buying houses.
But do you think that I think people in this country like something like a royal wedding once every 5 or 8 years? It gets a sort of injection of fantasy into their lives.
Oh yes, I agree about that. This is something we were talking about earlier, and it's part of the British way of life, I suppose, and it will obviously continue as far as one can see.
But it's amazing to see, though, the development there's been in the PR between the royal family and the public. We had that royal family film, which showed them all sort of mucking in and being very much closer to us. Then we had that that interview with Mark and Anne, which I thought actually spaced the royal family suddenly about 20 years back, actually, as far as public accessibility went. They did not seem to be people like us. And then today, when, again, they did not seem to be people like us, they seemed okay, as Godfrey Talbot said, to be having a private family do. But again, it was something that we were on the other side of the cage from. We were looking through the bars and looking through the plate glass window.
Well, yes, I think that's right. Obviously, the monarchy lags behind. I don't think the monarch can set trends very much in this respect. I think we should be happy if the monarchy gets into the second half of the 20th century in the next decade.
What about,
you know what I mean?
What about Prince Charles now?
Well, obviously some of his glory was stolen today, his birthday, poor man.
And also the Archbishop of Canterbury's birthday, which was sadly overlooked.
Really, I didn't know about that. I was horror-stricken to hear about that. He's certainly, I suppose, got to get married sometime. It's an inescapable thing for him, really. He's got to marry and, I suppose, produce an heir. And I don't know, he's looking forward to this or not. He hasn't done it yet, but we can hope for developments, I suppose.
I've got a few tips for him after today.
Well, I suppose, so, yes.
Any princesses lined up, do you think?
I'm not sure. I think it would be rather good, as I was saying earlier, if Prince Charles were to marry a nice girl without any aristocratic connections in her background whatsoever, then I would believe more in this forward-looking monarchy theme, you know?
Janet, your chance at last.
Well, I don't really... I'd like him to marry an ordinary girl, but he can't marry me because I'm already married. Very sad.
And that makes all...
I missed my chance.
That makes all of London sad, Janet. And that is about it from Royal Wedding Special, from me, David Jessel, from Janet Street Porter, from all our studio guests throughout these last 5 hours, throughout the morning. Thanks for listening. I hope we've brought you some of the atmosphere of today's festivities on LBC's first outside broadcast, first major outside broadcast. And it's now just about 2 o'clock.
This is the London Broadcasting Company, LBC, the independent voice of radio news.
Good afternoon, it's 2 o'clock, and this is Mike Lewis with the news. 7 people have died and 20 are injured following an explosion in Birmingham at an Imperial Metal Industries plant. A spokesman for IMI said the explosion was in the section of the building where sporting cartridges are packed in boxes. Birmingham General Hospital said that 4 people have been brought in dead on arrival and 4 others are injured. IMI said that 16 injured people were treated at the scene. An IMI spokesman said the company had set up a committee of inquiry to investigate the cause of the explosion, which was not yet known. The roof of the building caved in, and there was minor damage to neighbouring buildings caused by flying debris. The first government move to cut the use of electricity will be announced this afternoon. Peter Allen reports from Parliament on the power situation.
Regulations reducing the use of electricity are to be introduced under the state of emergency. They will be published at Westminster this afternoon. I understand that from midnight tonight, there will be a ban on electric central heating in offices, shops, restaurants and places of entertainment. Display advertising and lighting of arenas such as football pitches will also be cut. And government departments, nationalised industries and local authorities will all be told today to economise. This is the first of 3 possible stages in dealing with the energy crisis. The second stage, which could follow soon, is an order to oil companies to allocate supplies. And the third stage is a rationing scheme, which could take 3 weeks to organise. For the present, the Central Electricity Generating Board...